The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Last week we talked about all of the five hindrances, and this week I want to zero in and talk specifically about the fifth hindrance, doubt. Doubt is a normal occurrence on the path, but believing doubt is a hindrance to concentration. It's the fifth hindrance. And the ability for doubt to arise at all comes from the existence of a particular fetter in the mind. And when that fetter is gone, then doubt no longer arises. So it's really worth studying doubt, especially if your mind has this tendency. I speak from experience. The first thing to do is to distinguish the type of doubt that is a hindrance and a fetter. So in particular, that is skeptical doubt, which means doubt that includes an element of shutting down, turning away, or looking down upon. Skeptical doubt opposes investigation. However, in contrast, asking good questions or wanting to know things for yourself, those actually encourage investigation. In fact, this type of doubt is praised on the path. So make sure that you know which kind of doubt you have. And in that light, let's dig in and examine doubt a little bit. First, I'm going to offer some metaphors for doubt that may help you connect with the experience in your own mind. I'll describe some specific examples of how doubt manifests, especially in modern Western practitioners. And I'll offer an array of tools for working with doubt once it has already arisen. So the Buddha offered some colorful analogies for doubt. The first, which we talked about a little bit last week, is a bowl of muddy water placed in the dark. So in such a bowl, a person cannot see his or her reflection clearly. So this points out that this is, shows the way a doubtful mind feels stirred up and unsettled, and at the same time is confused and unclear. So maybe you've experienced this for yourself. Even in English, actually, we have a phrase to settle one's doubts, right? Settle your doubts about something. So that we understand, even in our culture, that doubt is kind of a muddied state that needs some kind of settling. So I encourage you to examine what doubt feels like, particularly in your body and also in your mind. I have found, for example, that a doubtful mind actually has a feeling like it's hovering and not fully engaged. So, for example, if I'm trying to connect with the breath as an object, it's as if there's some distance between the mind and the breath, some kind of cloudiness or separation. And as the doubt settles, and I just settle down and do the practice, then it's almost as if the mind literally settles down onto the object, like it lowers down onto it. You can try this for yourself. If you're feeling some kind of doubt, instead of focusing on the doubt and the story that goes with it, see what it feels like in the body and see if you can identify this gap that you have between the doubt and whatever it is that is experienced at the moment. So another analogy for doubt that the Buddha offers is that it is like a well-to-do person getting lost in the desert. And then when the doubt ends, it's like arriving safely without being attacked by bandits. So this points towards the danger of doubt. It's considered to be a state of danger when one is in doubt. And it also points toward the relief that comes with the ending of doubt. I mean, you can picture for yourself, it's a vivid metaphor, you can picture for yourself what it would be like to be out on a desert road by yourself with some valuables with you. You don't know if you're going to be attacked by bandits, and then at some point you see a town and you arrive safely. That's the feeling of ending a doubt. So it points toward the pain of doubt also. Also along the theme of danger, there's a sutta in the middle length discourses that describes five wildernesses in the heart, and four of them are about doubt. So this is a sort of another powerful metaphor. If you extend it to a visual image, imagine the difference between struggling through the underbrush in a wilderness and walking on a smooth path. That's another difference. So I'd like to look a little bit into this wilderness in the heart idea that's in this sutta and talk about the manifestation of different kinds of doubt. So these four types of skeptical doubt are specifically, simply, doubt in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and the training, or the path, or the practice. So let me quote a little bit from this sutta, MN 16. What bhikkhus, and a bhikkhu just means a practitioner, what bhikkhus are the five wildernesses in the heart that a person has not abandoned? Here, a bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the teacher, and thus his mind does not incline to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving. As his mind does not incline to ardor, devotion, perseverance, and striving, that is the first wilderness in the heart that he has not abandoned. Again, a bhikkhu is doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the Dhamma, and so forth. Doubtful, uncertain, undecided, and unconfident about the Sangha and about the training. So I mentioned, by the way, that there are five wildernesses of the heart in this sutta, and I'll just say for completeness that the fifth one is that the bhikkhu is angry and displeased with his companions in the holy life. And there are other things in the sutta. But I want to focus on the four doubts, doubt in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and the training. So some of these overlap a little bit, like, for example, doubt in the Dhamma and doubt in the training, clearly some similarity there, since one meaning of the word Dhamma is the teachings and the training that the Buddha offered. So I would encourage you not to get too hung up on exactly which category we're in, and just know that these are kind of the different ways that doubt can come about. And I want to talk about them specifically for the way they tend to manifest in our times. So let's start with the first one, doubt in the Buddha. In the sutta, it literally said teacher when I read it, and it does refer to the literal Buddha in the sutta itself. So, but with some license, I will put doubt in teachers that we have, our lay teachers, in the Sangha category. So I'll get to that in a few minutes. And for this category, I'd like to focus more, again with a little creative license, on putting self-doubt in the category with the Buddha. So this is one of the big ones for us, and particularly one that I've encountered. So we may doubt that we can actually sit down and practice, sit down and meditate. That's often the first doubt. I've had many people say to me after their first sitting, oh, I just completely couldn't do it. My mind was everywhere. And it's sort of said with a tone of, you know, clearly this isn't the right thing for me, or leaning towards that direction, or maybe seeking some kind of assurance, like, I think this isn't the right thing for me because of what happened, dot, dot, dot. And so this is just a basic manifestation of doubt. But given that meditation is a skill, like many other skills that we can learn, how good were you the first time you played the piano, or the first time you played volleyball, or the first time anything? Maybe you're a painter now, and the first thing you ever painted when you were very young. It takes some practice to learn to do meditation like anything else. And, you know, unlike maybe a physical skill where the point is to become very, you know, we might say the point is to become really good at it, I'm not sure we necessarily need to become really good at meditation in some objective sense. It's actually that the practice itself does other things. But it's important not to be discouraged by the way, you know, by the way the mind might feel immediately, oh, this isn't for me. And it'll come back again and again, especially if you're struggling, because this practice is a purification practice, tends to bring up difficult emotions or confusions of various kinds that have been lurking there, and we finally see them. So all of this can lead to a lot of self-doubt. It's one common manifestation. I'll mention later some things for working with this. So the second kind of doubt is doubt in the Dhamma. And here, we're skeptical of the teachings to the point of not being able to practice. Again, it's not questioning the teachings, that's okay. Or wanting to see for ourselves if the teachings are true, that's exactly what the Buddha encouraged. But when it becomes a skeptical doubt and a hindrance to practice, it means you're turning away from those investigations and simply, say, arguing with the teachings, or not willing to practice until certain things about the teachings are resolved for you. We may doubt the existence of Nibbana. We may want to argue about the existence of the self, about rebirth. We may want to defend the value of anger and many other things, and we may feel strongly that if these issues are not cleared up, we can't really undertake the practice. So that would be a manifestation of doubt, if you're so concerned about the teachings in a certain way that you're not willing to sit down and meditate with them. The third kind of doubt, doubt in the Sangha. So one way this manifests is that we may doubt our teachers, because here in the West, our teachers often play the role of spiritual friend, and they're often lay people like us. So we may ask, is this person really speaking the true Dharma? Do they really enact the Dharma in their life? And again, this is fine in itself. There are actually instructions given in the texts about how to choose a teacher and how to decide if a teacher is valid. However, if we stop with our questions and we don't actually investigate or check out if this person's teachings are valid, then we may be caught in doubt. You know, we may stop practicing because somebody else doesn't appear to be true enough to us, and that harms us, right? Doubt is harmful to oneself. Another way that doubt in the Sangha can manifest is if we become skeptical of our peers on the path, feeling that their practice is somehow not inspiring to the point where we don't practice ourselves. And so, again, this would be placing so much emphasis on others' actions that we harm our own actions. We don't practice ourselves. So if you're feeling doubt about your peers, just be aware that that's considered a hindrance and a manifestation of this fetter of doubt. So the fourth kind of doubt is doubt in the training or the practice or the path. We may doubt the efficacy of the process. This is especially true when the going gets tough. So this is why it's important to have strong teachers and friends on the path. Some of the other points that were mentioned earlier, the Sangha, faith in the Buddha. What we're doing here is very profound and amazing in a sense. We're actually reshaping our mind through the process of meditation. We're changing the way our consciousness interacts with experience. And there are times when this is a little shaky, and we may feel challenged by the way we're experiencing things, the way we're perceiving things. Stuff that used to be certain becomes uncertain. Of course, everything is uncertain. And so this can bring up doubts. What am I doing? Is this really going to take me to somewhere better? or at least somewhere that's described in the practice. And this kind of doubt can be very insidious. It can prevent us from letting go in our meditation or in our life in certain ways that would actually be beneficial. Doubt has its own internal twisted logic that keeps looping in on itself. It's characterized at the gross level by a lot of discursive thinking that tends to go in circles and not in a line. Doubt has a lot of lawyers. And so all of these four types of skeptical doubt will come with convincing voices that explain to you why all of this is true and why it really makes sense for you to do a certain thing or not do a certain thing. Now, of course, there are times when we need to do things or not need to do things and listen to our internal voices. So this is part of the development of wisdom, is to be able to distinguish genuine wisdom from doubt masquerading as wisdom or other hindrances masquerading in various ways. So it's okay if you're not 100% accurate. If sometimes you believe the doubt and then realize later that you shouldn't have, that's okay. Don't worry about it. It's like falling into anger or anything else. Gill tells the story of a fairly advanced practitioner who was doing a self-retreat, and she had what she called a multiple hindrance attack that included many hindrances, including doubt, and she became convinced that she should stop her retreat in the middle of it. And they told a very good story about why this was a good idea. She left the retreat, she booked her plane, changed her plane ticket home, and on the plane on the way home, she realized, oh, that was doubt. On the plane. So, you know, you can go through a lot of action before you realize what it was that gripped your mind. So this is all part of the practice. At a finer level, doubt is just a wavering of the mind and an uncertainty about what to trust. There can be a feeling in this practice like we're constantly falling over the edge of a cliff or slipping off a floor. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche says we feel like we're constantly slipping off a floor. And doubt can feel like that moment of concern where it's like, ah, I don't know if there's something to... You know, what can be trusted here when everything seems to be falling away? So there are a lot of ways to work with doubt, since it's going to happen. It's normal. And I've listened to many tips, and I've even invented some of my own, so I'll just describe some of them. And it's certainly not complete. I hope you have your own, but I hope also that what I offer can be helpful. So one particular one is to doubt the doubt, as it's said. And so if you're doubting everything else, why not doubt the arising of that doubt? Why are you believing that when you're not believing whatever the doubt says you shouldn't believe? Why not do it completely? This one can be helpful. I've used it on occasion when there was light doubt arising, but for me at least, this one's a little bit lightweight, and it doesn't work for serious doubt. You may find different. There are other helpful phrases, so doubting the doubt is kind of a concept that you can apply. There are other helpful phrases you may say to yourself. You may find things that work frequently when you're having periods of doubt. As a specific example, I was on a long retreat recently, and I found myself in a period of self-judgment where it felt like my practice was kind of failing. So, you know, self-judgment is a little bit aversion, but it had kind of an element of doubt to it. I wasn't quite sure that the practice was exactly working. And in my particular case, I just added the phrase, "The work is being done," to the recognition of mindfulness. It sounds kind of funny, but I would have a moment of mindfulness. And I was usually mindful of doubt or something, some unpleasant mind state. And then I would add to it, the work is being done. Just by being present, something is happening. That was my way of reminding myself that simply being on retreat was a wholesome thing to do. And I didn't need to have doubt about whether the practice was working, about whether I was doing the right thing. Actually, being on retreat is itself really wholesome. And so just by bringing that to mind, and I had to do it frequently, you know, from sort of a whole afternoon session, I was constantly reminding myself, yes, the work is being done just by being present, just by being here. And by just cutting off the doubt like that, again and again, moment by moment, even every time it rearose, again and again, eventually it faded on its own. This is the nature of doubt, to slowly settle, like the mud in the water slowly settles. You can't make mud and water settle, by the way. You can't, like, push the pieces down, right? All you can do is wait. Okay, another tip, this is one that's actually given in the suttas, is to speak with wise people or to speak with a teacher. If you're feeling doubt about your practice or about what's going on, go and talk with a teacher and say, I have these concerns, I have these doubts. I would expand it a little bit to the following. If you're doubting one of the four things listed, the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, or the path, find another one that you're currently not doubting and focus on that. The reason I say that is that telling someone to go to a teacher when they're doubtful is not helpful if you're doubting your teachers at that moment. So the more general version is, look around at those four choices of things that you're doubting, figure out which one it is that you're concerned about. If you're not doubting one of the other three, focus on that. So often this can mean going to the teacher with a question if you're doubting the Dhamma, for example, or the training. However, if you're currently doubting the teacher, you might go with the training and just trust the process. I've found that to be helpful at times, is to just say, okay, this is a process that's happening. It's a little bit like the work is being done. This is a process that's happening, and even if I can't trust myself or trust the suttas or what somebody's telling me, I can at least trust this process. If I'm present for this process, something is unfolding. My experience tells me that from the past, and I can rely on that for the future. As kind of the flip side of this, I've experienced in the presence of certain teachers spontaneous faith arising. So it's worth noticing this. I had this happen. This is the reason I notice is that I'm not a strong faith type in terms of devotion to a guru or devotion to a particular teacher, although more and more I find that's true, interestingly. So, but I'm always surprised when it appears very viscerally for me. And I had an experience on this last retreat, actually, where a teacher that I've worked with before was arriving partway through the retreat. He wasn't teaching the whole retreat. And the first day that he arrived, I'd already been on retreat for a while. And I opened my eyes during the meditation. He arrived after we were sitting. And this feeling began to arise in me of kind of an upwelling of energy. And it was pleasant, a happy feeling. And I quickly realized, oh, this is faith. It's just arising just from seeing this teacher. So it's a strong effect when it's occurring. So if you're able to do that, you know, if you're experiencing doubt, by all means, go and see a teacher that tends to inspire that in you. It's much more pleasant than the pain of doubt. But in the end, maybe we just trust the process. So I've saved what for me is the most powerful way to work with doubt for my last offering here, which is to turn directly into the doubt. This takes some courage. Turn directly into it and feel the pain of the insincerity that lies at the core of skeptical doubt. Skeptical doubt is about non-wholeness, non-integrity. It's actually extremely unpleasant. We want to be whole. We want to be integrated. We want to be sincere. So we want very much to have something deep inside of us that we trust so unconditionally that that doubt just falls away like water off a lotus. We want that, and we want to be true in our actions also. We don't want to be saying one thing and thinking another, acting in a certain way, but feeling inside like it's not what we really want to do. or acting in a certain way, but doubting the way we're acting. That's the pain of doubt. It has a core of insincerity to it, a difference between outer and inner. And if you can feel the pain of that, that's often enough actually to allow the doubt to fall away. It's kind of like homeopathic medicine. So really immerse yourself in what you're doing when you're in doubt. Do you really want that feeling of doubt inside of you? It may be that doubt is the most painful of the hindrances because it negates the very spiritual potential that brings us to the path. I mean, we're here because of some deep yearning inside of us. And to doubt that is to question your own heart. Maybe, I think it's even more painful than anger, personally. This may be why doubt is first abandoned. It's the first hindrance to go, maybe because it's the most painful. So when doubt is abandoned at any level, it feels like finding the path. The mind changes from a stance of holding back and being unwilling to engage, you know, that lifting away that I talked about earlier, to stepping forward into the fullness of the present moment. So to complete the analogies that I mentioned earlier, when doubt is abandoned, we escape from the wilderness in the heart. We find safety after being lost in the desert, and the mud in our mind settles out so that we can see clearly. There's a tangible sense of completion and of clarity and of resolution when doubt ends, whenever it ends. And, you know, if a little thought of doubt goes away, or if doubt is completely abandoned. Early on, this abandoning of doubt may not last. We'll again get stirred up. So it's important to notice the good feeling that happens when doubt is gone. Notice the feeling of safety or the feeling of completion or the feeling of sincerity or resolution. This does two things. First of all, your heart will remember that good feeling at some level and might be able to look for it again when doubt is there again. And second, and more fundamentally, the heart becomes aware that doubt is something that arises and passes. So if you notice the feeling that happens when doubt ends, then at some level what you're noticing is, oh, doubt has ended. It arose and it passed. So you're learning at a fundamental level that doubt is impermanent. It's not there all the time. It has causes, and when those causes cease, then the doubt also ceases. So there comes a point in practice where there is still doubt, but the mind is able to see it as just one more arising. Oh, there's doubt. How nice to see you again, my friend. I know that you won't last. So at the beginning, I mentioned that doubt is both a hindrance to concentration and a fetter in the mind. And doubt is completely abandoned when this fetter is cut or just fades away over time. Then doubt can no longer arise, and that's an important moment in practice. You've seen for yourself, so there's no way to doubt anymore. And remember that what we're talking about again here is skeptical doubt, doubt in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and the path, doubt that results in turning away rather than turning toward. So even after the fetter of doubt is gone, that doesn't mean that your life is just one continuous, clear certainty. You know, I know how to do everything and it all falls into place. That would be a little idealistic. Actually, there will still be everyday uncertainty and confusion. What should I do in this situation? And there can even be deep questioning about certain teachings or about how the path is unfolding. But they will be the type of questions that lead to investigation, not to turning away. Here's an example. Joseph Goldstein, who you may know as a very well-known teacher in our practice, after many years of Vipassana practice in the Theravadan tradition, he began studying in the Tibetan tradition. He got interested in that. And he ran into difficulty with the Tibetan teachings because they seemed to contradict very clear teachings that he had experienced for himself in his Theravada practice. So what do you do with that? You know, you're a highly well-developed practitioner and a teacher who's also Buddhist, but in the Tibetan tradition, is telling you things that contradict your direct experience. Well, at that point, Joseph had no skeptical doubt. So he engaged the Tibetan teachings and he learned for himself how to hold them. In fact, the result of this investigation, which was pretty deep for him, is the book called One Dharma, which we have in the library here. I'd recommend reading it. So he had definite doubt about these teachings he was receiving that sounded very different from what he knew from his own experience. But it allowed his mind, by engaging them, it allowed his mind to expand and to hold all of Buddhist practice in a bigger container than he had been seeing before. So his doubt turned him toward investigation and toward deeper practice, as opposed to the skeptical doubt that turns us away from the path, shuts us down, makes us smaller. So doubt is not a problem so long as you don't believe it so thoroughly that you stop practicing. We all come to practice seeking something, be it less stress, better relationships, a stronger sense of self-worth, deeper compassion, or freedom from suffering. And one of the greatest gifts we can give to ourselves and to the whole world is to settle our doubts and to know that there is something beyond conditions. So ending doubt is the end of the seeking that brought us to practice, actually. We may still be seeking complete freedom after that, but it's a different process. So may your doubts settle, and may you use them to engage with the path more deeply. Thank you. We have some time for comments or questions. Oh yeah, thanks for using the mic.
Long before I became acquainted with any of the Buddhist practice, I had lots of doubts, including self-doubts. I'm wondering whether, in your experience, it is helpful once one is practicing to attempt to address both the doubts, as you've described about the Buddha, the Sangha, the practice, etc., and leave those other doubts by the wayside, or whether one should try to work or investigate all of them, including the ones that aren't specifically related to the practice.
I see. I don't want to sound too formulaic in terms of, you know, let's classify this doubt into one of the four, and if it's an acceptable doubt, then we'll investigate it, and if it isn't, we'll ignore it. I think that algorithm may not serve necessarily. There can be doubts that are sound like they're not related to the four of those, but are so strong that, you know, you need to work with what's right in front of you. So I don't know your specific situation, but I mostly pointed to the types of skeptical doubt so that people would understand, to convey kind of the doubts that really hinder us on the path. But there can be other kinds of doubt that are needed as, you know, that need to be addressed also, and which may actually be part of those four, but you don't recognize it on the surface. So I would say go with the hindrance that's right in front of you. Do you want to share anything more specific, or is that a good enough answer for you?
Well, that's a fine answer for that question. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, Arthur.
I think this is more a comment, but it might not be. I'm not sure how this will come out. So I've experienced doubt in a more complicated way than I would have thought about it. And the way it's arisen for me is a teacher, person, has said something that disturbs my self-concept, my sense of who I am.
Okay.
And so there's a reaction of, first the reaction is fear and anger, and it's probably more complicated than that. And I left a retreat once and thought about leaving other retreats several times over that issue.
Hmm.
Once I left, I was close enough. My home was close enough to the retreat to go back. But it was doubt. But it's mixed with other things.
Yeah, so hindrances often pair together. Birds of a feather flock together. So if you have one hindrance, it's easy to kind of have other ones glom onto that. Very often doubt is mixed with fear, I've found. And you've said that it's mixed with anger also. So what I hear, though, is that even though these feelings prompted actual physical action in leaving a retreat, for example, when you saw what had happened, you made a different choice and actually went back to the retreat. How did it feel to go through that process? Like, what is it, for example, when the doubt and the fear fall away and then you can make the decision to return? I'm curious what's going through your mind at that point.
Well, this is a while ago.
Hold the microphone up.
But it was a very vivid experience. It was a while ago.
Uh-huh.
It was a very vivid experience, but memory distorts things a lot. So it was a retreat with Upandita, and there were several disciple monks of his who I knew. I used to teach them English frequently. This was in the U.S., though. Yeah. And I don't exactly know what arose, but I couldn't stay there. I didn't really want to leave. I was a very serious student, dedicated. But I just couldn't stand being there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It was really uncomfortable. I kept thinking about going home and eating regular food and so forth.
Right.
I just all kinds of things were arising. And I left, and I got home, and I felt terrible at having left. I didn't think of it as doubt. I just knew I had made the wrong choice.
Mm-hmm.
And that all the things that I left for were very unsatisfying, and I didn't. Anyway, I went back to the retreat, and I spoke to with great hesitation and great discomfort and fear and sorrow, all kinds of things, all kinds of emotions mixed together. And I went to see one of the monks who I knew, and of course he was very kind to me, and I was just in tears for 10 minutes, 15 minutes as we spoke.
Mm-hmm.
None of it made any sense to me at the time. It's only much later that I realized that it was what we would call doubt, but again, it was mixed with a lot of fear of what was coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And anger at the teacher for not responding the way I would have wanted mm-hmm. him to.
Wow, thank you for sharing that. That more specifically, it gives a more vivid picture. I think what's coming up for me to comment on is that you've identified how difficult doubt is to see. At the time, it's this analogy that the Buddha has of a bowl of muddy water placed in the dark. The reason that it's placed in the dark is that, you know, doubt is often something that we don't see until later. And there are more noticeable things that come along with it, like the fear and the anger. We have more experience with that in a sense, or more, somehow that's more tangible to us in a lot of ways. Doubt can be subtle underneath, driving this, but we don't necessarily recognize that deeper level that's going on, sometimes until later. This is why doubt is especially insidious. It's another reason why it's a dangerous hindrance. So your story is vividly bringing out why these particular metaphors are used for doubt. And the need for compassion and kindness in working with it in ourselves or when we see it in others. It is really a difficult and painful and troublesome tendency of the mind and causes all kinds of things like this. That's why we need to hear about it and work with it and engage it when we can. And if, you know, you did exactly the right thing in the sense of going to the teacher, right? You did, and that helped apparently in some way. So I think this is a beautiful example of how to work with doubt, even if it's not recognized. Thank you. We have time for one more short one, or we could end. It's just 1 minute to 11. Okay, thank you.